the Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics, creators of the Bionic Studio, the smarter way to make radio. Radio
Today. Oh, hello there. Daryl Morris here from Talk Radio. Thank you very much to Radio Today for letting me hijack their podcast for a little bit and to speak to somebody that I have admired for a very, very long time. Chris Mason is a political correspondent for the BBC. He's one of those people that you will see pop up regularly on BBC News and 5 Live and Radio 4 to present and report. Occasionally, he hosts BBC Breakfast, and in 2019, he took over as the host of Any Questions on Radio 4, a proper institution from Jonathan Dimbleby. As well as that, of course, he fronts Brexitcast and Newscast and a whole bunch of other things. We have a really cracking conversation here, a wide-ranging chat about growing up in Yorkshire, his love of radio, he is a radio enthusiast to his core, also his time at Christ College in Cambridge, and then on to the corridors of power at Westminster. We also talked about how it felt to be left to fill on BBC One for about 3.5 hours while we waited for the Prime Minister to come and do one of his daily briefings. That and journalism, the future of journalism, and how Twitter plays a massive role as well in that whole industry. Lots and lots and lots to get into. And it started, as all good conversations do these days.
Hiya, can you hear me? Right, I wonder why I can't hear you. Can you hear me?
Right, you should actually be able to hear me now, I think.
Right, it says now you are connected to computer audio. I think I've got you now.
Oh, hello.
Hello, got
yes.
You. Brilliant.
We're only 10 months into this working from home. Like.
No, exactly. And we're only, paid to be radio broadcasters.
It's only a job. Okay, once we got that nonsense out of the way, we started here. I remember the first time that I saw you on the television.
Oh, no.
And I remember it like it was yesterday because you were at a count. It was a by-election. I can't remember the, I'm sure whatever it was, it was thrilling, I'm sure. And you were doing some updates into Andrew Neil doing the coverage in the studio. You were at the count. And the reason that it kind of really stands out to me is because I remember thinking, blimey, that guy sounds like me a bit. And he's on the television doing a report from a count, which was, I mean, even then, which won't be that long ago, really, to be honest with you, felt really refreshing.
Yeah, it's interesting. I found myself talking about this quite a lot, actually, particularly since I got Any Questions. The whole business of accents on the radio and the sound of radio. In fact, I made a Radio 4 documentary about accents a couple of years ago off the back of some of these conversations. And I still think that there's a massive issue, really, in British radio. The range of voices that you hear amongst the most prominent voices, in other words, presenters, it's still actually quite narrow. I think actually it's got a lot better in the last 10 or 20 years. And actually, I wonder to an extent, you know, if you go back a generation or so, there was the obsession about how a particular voice on the radio had to sound. And there was also the obsession about sort of perfect sound quality. And the last year has put paid to our obsessions with perfect sound quality, as you and I talking over a Zoom link and hoping for the best and all the rest of it. And at the same time, more broadly, there's been this kind of recognition, I think, across the industry that, you know, we need to sound more like the people we're broadcasting to. I still think there's a huge way to go, to be honest, in that across BBC and commercial radio. And hopefully, you know, as time goes on, we'll hear a greater range of voices, because there's still, you know, huge chunks of the UK that audibly, in terms of the sound of people on the air, you still do not hear. When did you last hear, you know, where I'm trying to think, is there a presenter with a West Country accent on national radio? Can't think of one. Is there a news presenter with a Geordie accent? No, can't think of one. Similarly, and news in particular, I think, there are certain accents you hear more prominently in entertainment shows. But yeah, I think there's still a way to go. But I think, to be fair, the various sort of, you know, bosses and controllers, program controllers, whatever, kind of get that now. It should never be the overarching factor, of course, in why somebody is hired. Of course it shouldn't. It's about what people have got to say, isn't it? And their competence and all the rest of it. But it certainly shouldn't be an exclusionary factor, which bluntly it must have been in the past. That can be the only explanation, I think.
And there's perhaps something going on, some unconscious biases that are going on there, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. And I think that's because, I remember when I started out in radio, people talking about having a good voice. And I remember finding that quite odd. And I get that up to a point, because of course the fundamental on the radio is you've got to be clear. That's point number one. And ideally you want to be pretty easy on the ear. Otherwise droves of people are going to turn off. Of course, what is easy on the ear is in the ear of the beholder. And I think sometimes there's been an assumption that certain sounds are seen to be inherently better than others. And I think once you account for clarity, because it's for me, there can be no negotiation around clarity, then actually the rest of it, I do feel, is probably bound up in all sorts of sort of prejudices and unconscious biases and that sort of thing. And I think this is a separate thing, Daryl, from, you know, people's presentational style or skills. Because I remember when I first started out and I bunged out demo tapes and whatever, and people would offer, you know, pretty direct feedback, and sometimes people would be critical of voice. What I realize now actually is that those people, most of the time, I don't think were critical of any accent. They were critical around delivery and pacing and intonation and that kind of stuff. And that kind of stuff we all work on all of the time, and you get better with practice. I think that's an entirely separate issue from the issue of accent, which, as I say, I still think is a colossal issue. I like the fact, though, that Daryl, you remember the by-election counts, because what I loved about covering those is that you could delight in relatively insignificant news, because of course it mattered for the people who won and lost on the night, but it never these things rarely change the complexion of a government. They are not particularly newsworthy in the grand scheme of things, and it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm sort of talking nonsense to Andrew Neil on BBC One, and I think the last year has taught us of the joys and the delights of being able to talk about news that doesn't matter very much when we've spent the last year talking about, you know, this kind of most horrific news you can imagine, really.
It does feel like a golden age, that, doesn't it? A simpler time. That will also be pre-Brexit as well, which we'll come on to talk about in a sec. I wonder if just on the accents thing as well, because, and not to be obsessed with this necessarily, sort of hear people thinking, oh, these two northerners harking on about how hard it is to be northern, but my accent has changed, and it's nowhere near as broad as it was. I had a very thick, very broad Bolton accent, and I remember having a conversation twice actually with two bosses, because at the time I was doing hit music radio. So they said, if you want to have a career in hit music radio, if you want to work on Capital or you want to work on Galaxy, as it was, you're going to have to flatten your vowels. You're going to have to change your accent, effectively.
Isn't that interesting?
And I think maybe subconsciously that happened to me. Has that ever happened to you, either directly or maybe even you feeling the pressure to do it, even if somebody didn't necessarily directly ask you to?
Never happened directly, but I definitely sort of, I was aware of it. But then very quickly, I became pretty belligerent about it and just thought, you know what, this is me and this is how I sound. And I think I was fortunate that our sort of careers have coincided with, certainly in the last decade or so, this kind of it being fashionable to be authentic, that authenticity is seen as a valuable asset. And perhaps if I think back to some of the radio that I absolutely adored of my youth in the 1990s, it was brilliant in so many ways, but it probably wasn't hugely authentic in terms of style of delivery, the kind of voices that were on the air. And so I think, you know, the coming of that fashion for authenticity, as well as perhaps that broader awareness that we should sound more like the people we're broadcasting to, has probably in the end sort of done me some favours and helped me to stand out, really, in a sea of, you know, anonymous, bland, suit-wearing political correspondents, of which I am one. You know, and if you're in this crowd of people who will look and sound the same and are talking about the same stuff, as wonderful as all of my colleagues are, how do you stand out? Well, you know, there might be things you can proactively do to make yourself stand out. And journalistically, of course, you're always trying to do that. But there are perhaps some things that make you stand out just that are unchangeable. And so if one of those for me has been how I sound, then you know, that's I guess has probably been an advantage. And you know what, Daryl, I actually now lean into it a bit. So what not the accent, because I don't think you can do anything about that, and mine's probably, I'm pretty certain mine has kind of mellowed a bit. In fact, when I go back home to Yorkshire, alas, something I've not done anywhere near as much of in the last year as I would like. People will often say, "Oh, you know, you're sounding southern now," but in London, it's always the opposite. So again, it's kind of in the ear of the beholder. But I'm now conscious in scripted stuff that I do that if I can, where appropriate, and this is around language rather than accent, you know, pick a word that is very, more consciously of where I'm from rather than the environment I now find myself in. I sometimes will do that. So I'll talk about having my tea, which I still do authentically anyway, rather than sort of adopting the language of the southeast of England, sitting on the settee, like saying that winds people up, or some people anyway. The right people. It rounds up the right people. So I talk about sitting on the settee and stuff like that. So I have to admit, I do kind of lean into it a bit because language is our currency, isn't it, in radio? And so I kind of think we should, as a Yorkshireman, I like to spend my money wisely. So I like to spend my currency wisely when it comes to words as well. And, you know, you'll know from your time in sort of hip music radio, the kind of word economy mantra and how important that is. And therefore picking everywhere word very carefully. And I'm conscious of, you know, trying to do that because that's, again, it's our only mechanism of communication, isn't it, really?
Yeah. And actually, you've hit on something really important there, because having regional, I'd say northern, but you know, regional voices on the radio, wherever they're from, West Country or the North or you know, or Scotland as well, and Northern Ireland and those the nations, is as much about having a certain perspective, right? Totally. Over a story or over a situation, as much as it is just talking in an accent.
Oh, completely, absolutely right. This is exactly it, and I think you need. I think the oddity and the challenge we face, you know, broadcasting from Westminster, is that London is arguably more atypical compared with the rest of the UK than anywhere else, because it's a global city that happens to be our national capital, and we're a sort of uniquely centralized country in many ways, you know, for better or worse, and there's an argument to be had around that. But you know, the center of the UK in many senses, culturally, economically, politically, as I say, for better or worse, is London. And you know, you compare that with America, where the political center is separate from the economic center, which is separate from the cultural center, arguably, with Washington, New York, and Los Angeles. I paint with a broad, generic brush there, but broadly speaking, there's probably something in that. And so if you live, as I do, in London, and so your day-to-day life experience is in London, but you're broadcasting to a country which, in many senses, is very different in all sorts of ways, then at least if you have sort of a heritage that means you sort of grew up elsewhere, you have family elsewhere, you're regularly in touch with elsewhere, you regularly visit elsewhere. It's one of the advantages of any questions in normal times, that traveling around the country every week. Mm-hmm. Then, yeah, exactly. It exposes you to a greater range of perspectives and outlooks, which then kind of inform your judgments and ensure that you're not sort of unintentionally blinkered about what matters or what's relevant or what concerns people or what delights people. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, in that sense, I mean, you know, the accent stuff is all well and good and it's important and all of that, but actually journalistically, certainly what's more important is making sure that that people aren't shouting at the radio at you, not because of how you sound, but because of the, you know, the assumptions and prejudices that you might bring as a result of sort of where you live and the people you spend your life surrounded by.
Which is in part the reason why I've stayed up north. You know, it was a brutal experience doing 5 days a week. I do two now on talk radio, obviously. And doing 5 days a week and commuting up and down was really brutal. But for me, it kind of felt like my contribution to the landscape was to be on a national radio station, but be here, but be in Manchester. I live in Salford, grew up in Bolton. You know, that felt quite important to me.
Totally. Yeah. You know, it of course, it just exposes you to sort of, as I say, a sort of different perspectives. I mean, that's always the joy, isn't it? Being on a national outlet that you think simultaneously somebody in Cornwall and in Dundee is listening and hopefully contributing to that conversation, either directly calling you, for instance, calling me on any questions, or, you know, talking to the radio or shouting at the radio in the kitchen or whatever.
Yeah, we've also fallen into the trap here, Chris, of two Northerners chirping on about regional representation for hours and hours on end.
Exactly.
You mentioned that about your listening habits growing up and listening to radio. Okay, take me back there, Chris. What sort of informed your thinking? What was the first things that you listened to as a youngster?
I was given a little white, battery-powered, sort of handheld radio when I was probably about six. I flicked it on, and the two stations that I came across growing up in Grassington in the Yorkshire Dales, so fairly close to the East Lancashire border, the two stations I came across were Radio Lancashire and the football commentaries. All of the cliches, but they're true for that reason of the theatre in the mind and being taken to a place and the voices and the cadences and the crowd noise and all that kind of thing. And then I stumbled across a station you used to broadcast on, which was Rock FM. And that kind of coincided with me getting a slightly more, a better radio, basically, a kind of little hi-fi thing, which I've still got, actually, with a tape deck and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, discovering Rock FM and the sound of it made Preston sound like Las Vegas. Well, it did to me as a kid in the Yorkshire Dales. I mean, I knew of Preston, but we would only drive through it when we were going out to the M6. So I didn't really know Preston as a place at all. But as a listener, I felt like I got to know it. Tokyo Joe's nightclub. You know, I feel like I spent every Friday night in there, even though I've never been, because it was forever being mentioned. And the power of radio in those formative years, I can name the lineup of Rock.
Well, then, what era are we talking?
So we're talking mid 90s. So you can talk about Brian Moore doing breakfast, Rob Charles on mid morning. Actually, there was a stint when Brian Moore was doing lunchtimes and Kev Seeb was doing breakfast. And then Simon Ross, who's now at Greatest Hits, was doing drive time. And Glenn Hunt, who I occasionally cross paths with because he does some shifts at Five Live as a studio director, was doing the evening show. And I always joke about Glenn's Big One, which was the name he attached to, you know, a kind of record of the week type thing. And a music powered half hour at 9:30 in the evening. I just loved, as I say, the theatre of the mind. The station sound was astonishingly kind of big and upbeat. And proud of where it was from. And then, you know, around about that time, Atlantic 252 was very big, really, really big, particularly in the north of England. And then along came Century in Manchester, which I could also pick up, 105.4. Derek Hatton doing his lunchtime phone-in, and then Tony Horn arriving from Metro. And I absolutely loved that because there was that bit more speech content in there, which I kind of quite liked. So those stations were sort of massive influence. And then Five Live in the mid 90s, that was a huge influence. I didn't listen to a vast amount of Radio 4 at the time, a little bit, because my mum's kitchen lights took the medium wave signal out weirdly whenever she turned it on. You know, like when you go into a load of pylons on the motorway and it takes out, you're listening to Alan Green or whatever, or John Murray, and there's a crucial moment in the football, you go into a load of pylons, come out the other side, there's been a goal, you've missed the entire thing, so just this blitz of white noise. Anyway, my mum's kitchen lights had the same effect as those flipping pylons, and she'd, yeah, turn them on. So yeah, I'd wake up, I'd turn the radio on, there'd be Julian Warwicker and Victoria Derbyshire doing Five Live Breakfast, I'd catch a little bit of that, and then, of course, you know, it's getting up for school time, and my mum would put the kitchen lights on. Out went that. So occasionally I did venture in the direction of Radio 4, but Five Live was a big influence then. And yeah, and then that was my nerdy radio obsessed youth. And from that point on, I just sort of fell in love with the medium. And for all of the fun I have doing telly, whether it be at the by-election at 3 o'clock in the morning, or BBC Breakfast, which I do quite a bit of, and all the TV bulletins or whatever, all the online stuff. For me, my love of radio as a medium, that kind of one-on-one connection, the intimacy, particularly in tough times like the last year, I think you'll just never be beaten. The kind of simplicity of it, in many senses, there isn't the clutter and the faff of telly. There's just a kind of clarity to the storytelling, reverence for language and that human connection and those conversations.
I mean, those people that you reeled off there, you have relationships with them, right? I mean, those are relationships that were formed between them and you in your bedroom. And
totally. I mean, I remember this is probably about 10 years ago now. Stuart Clarkson, of this very podcast, and as it happens, an old schoolmate of mine, I was in Manchester at one of the party conferences, and he texted me and he said, I'm out for a drink with Glenn Hunt. tonight. Do you want to come? And I say this with no sense of I'm not for a moment meaning to be sort of ironic or flippant here. Genuinely, that, you know, there are very few people who would have, it would have excited me more to meet, actually, because here was a guy who I listened to every evening, and he depped on Breakfast as well at the time. Every evening in my formative years, full stop, but certainly my formative radio years. So he was a colossal influence. And the chance to shake his hand and have a pint in that era where you could do both of those things without being sort of arrested was just fantastic. Yeah. And the, as you say, you know, those, the influence and power of those kind of voices around radio is just massive. And there's no equivalent in telly. You know, I listened to watch loads of telly at the time, particularly television news, as an aspiring journalist. And there's huge numbers of things I could point to that I revere, but none of them have that connection for me of that kind of relationship, as you say, that as a listener you have with a presenter or a program that just sticks with you. And when Greatest Hits came on DAB in London, I was drawn back to it because Simon Ross, rhythm driven at drive time, as he used to say on 97.4, was there doing Breakfast. And it's this familiar voice who I hadn't heard in years. And you turn on and a bit like an old friend, you think, oh yeah, there's a familiarity.
Well, nothing quite vouches for radio like it made Preston sound like Las Vegas. Because it's not like Las Vegas, that I can confirm. Although I can confirm that they do still have, they've moved studios now, actually. To Manchester, I think they're based now, aren't they? The Breakfast Show comes out of Manchester. Mm. But at the time, the process, when I went there for the first time, because I grew up in Bolton, and so Rock FM was kind of like one of my local stations, right?
It was
right on my doorstep. But the processing of the microphone was pretty much the same as it was back in that era. You know, you felt like you were on top, talking to that microphone, you felt like you were on top of the world.
Right.
You were the most important person in the world.
I can believe that, because that's how it sounded. It just knew what it was doing. It knew what it was doing, and it knew what it wanted to do. And it seemed to me to achieve it. I wonder if we're honest, there's a little bit of a trade-off, going back to our earlier conversation about voices, authenticity, between what we recall then and perhaps what we aspire or what is valued now. In that sense, of course, everything evolves, doesn't it? And something that nailed its time and nailed its era was hugely successful, even if you were willing to conclude it wouldn't quite sound right now. And I don't know if it'd sound right now because, I haven't got enough of it on tape, alas, to be able to kind of come to that judgment. But I do wonder if those two things are slightly connected.
Well, you nailed it, actually. It nailed its era. That's the perfect way to describe it. It nailed its era. You went from bedroom listening to Five Live and Rock FM and Atlantic, etc., to Christ's College. Feels like a hell of a journey. How was it, Chris, as a Yorkshireman, accent and all, walking into an institution like Christ's College, Cambridge?
It was intimidating, is the honest truth. I'm incredibly conflicted, actually, Daryl, when I think back to my time there, because here was this sort of chippy northern grammar school boy rolling up in Cambridge. I'd been persuaded to apply. I couldn't believe that I'd got in. You know, I mean, I was very lucky. I'd been to a brilliant state school. I had very supportive parents. There were people who were there who were from sort of much more kind of humble backgrounds than me. But you know, the thing is, I think what it was, you know, I struggle with a couple of hours of a Sunday afternoon at a stately home, and suddenly I found myself living in one for three years. And the weird thing was that I couldn't help but think that kind of half the people there kind of seemed to instantly fit in and have a feel for the place. And I just found it kind of really weird. You know, some people kind of gave the impression that they knew they were going to end up there since about the age of eight. And you could have asked me a year before, and I'd have regarded the idea as fanciful. Even 6 months before, when I was sort of slogging through my A levels, it did seem very alien. I mean, there's weird things that I remember that just kind of irritated me. So we weren't allowed televisions in our room. Now, I think there was a wholesome kind of argument behind that kind of idea, which was, you know, you're better off socializing and seeing your friends and all of that rather than sitting in your room on your own watching the telly. And there's probably something in that, but you know, I wanted to work in broadcasting and I couldn't watch the telly. And I just thought that was kind of Stone Age, to be honest. And then the other thing, because we were talking about Rock FM, the other thing that that I had to adjust to, you know, is my chippy 18-year-old self, was that I'd wave goodbye to listening to 97.4 Rock FM, you know, huge personality station and all the rest of it. And I turn up in Cambridge, and the local station, you know, I'd dip into the BBC local for a bit of news, but the local commercial station was Q103. To be fair, smaller than Rock, but it just seemed so bland. It was the GWR group of stations at the time. And I know that was the format, and clearly it worked for them kind of commercially. So, you know, who am I to grumble? But I just seemed so bland compared with Rock, which had all those sort of towering personalities, apart from the one voice that sticks in my head from that time in college, was Graham Torrington. Did late nights on Q103 and all of the GWR network. And that was a program that had personality and knew what it was doing. And Graham knew what he was doing in terms of the tone of voice and the conversations he was having and the phone calls and the storytelling. Oh, that was good. But you know what? I can't remember. I've been racking my brains about this, and I cannot remember the name of a single other presenter on that station in those 3 years, which I think kind of tells you all you need to know really about that format.
Well, whilst Chris tries to remember, let me not forget to tell you about Clean Feed, because whether you're hosting an interview, an OB, or doing some co-hosting with somebody else, Clean Feed is designed for radio and podcasters, and now it's simple to connect live audio over the web. The quality is great, and you can record too. Clean Feed doesn't cost anything to get started, and you can find out more at cleanfeed.net.
Original music for this podcast was composed by Macasso.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics, creators of the Bionic Studio. Listening, watching, reacting to and learning from every spoken word, caller, tweet and SMS to unmix, unlock and understand your content. The Bionic Studio transforms everything about radio except the way you make it.
Just to drag you back to college and back to Cambridge, where did you find yourself on the scale between frustrated and intimidated?
It's a really good question. It's definitely a bit of both. So I think part of my irritation, and maybe a contributor to the intimidation, but certainly part of my irritation in my university years, which wasn't the fault of where I was that I knew what I wanted to do afterwards. And so when you're in a lecture about medieval village formation, because I studied geography, it might just cross your mind, you know, your chippy 18-year-old mind, how much use is this likely to be in a newsroom in a few years' time? Now, I know there is the argument about university, about it, you know, it broadening the mind and it's learning for its own sake and all the rest of it. And there's an element of that I have come to appreciate in the years since. But I can see why that did annoy me, given that I knew what I wanted to do afterwards. And it's kind of rare, I suppose, particularly if you're a sort of arty-farty kind of student doing one of those subjects like geography that could basically lead you in any direction, as opposed to being a, you know, studying medicine because you want to be a doctor. Most of my contemporaries didn't have the faintest idea what they were going to do. Nothing wrong with that. I was probably the narrow-minded one. But because I knew what I wanted to do and was very single-minded about that, that, I think, was a contribution to the frustration. But I think as well, I mean, bluntly, and this is probably as much me as it was the place, but, you know, lots of people talk, I mean, to such an extent that it's a cliche that, you know, university is the best years of your life. It just wasn't for me. It just wasn't. And I haven't kind of grown out of that kind of sentiment in the years since, really. The A1 northbound was a good place to be when I left. And I'm afraid that's just the kind of the blunt truth of it. It probably served me well. It probably taught me things. It taught me never to be intimidated, actually, again, because after I'd survived that place and got the measure of it and worked mighty hard at the end and did all right in the end after struggling for a few years, it probably taught me not to be intimidated. Yeah, I was glad to leave.
But it doesn't sound to me like what I would probably feel if I was in that situation, imposter syndrome.
Yeah, I think there was some imposter syndrome. And I don't think, I was talking to Ian Dale about this, actually, a while back. I still get occasional blasts of that. And I don't think that's necessarily such a bad thing. I always think, because it allows you, I think, to see yourself in a slightly more detached way if you're willing to acknowledge that you're thinking, what right have I got to be here? I think, yeah, there was probably a bit of imposter syndrome, but there was also, because I'm a sort of stubborn so-and-so, that in the end, I thought, I never, ever contemplated leaving during the time I was there, because that would have been kind of defeat. So I was never going to do that. And in the end, I thought the only way to kind of work my way through this place, alongside the kind of escapism of doing the media stuff, is to work out how this place works, particularly on the academic side, where I did struggle in the early kind of half of my time there, to try and work out what it is that they're kind of after. And I was very struck that some people, perhaps who weren't intimidated by, you know, spending 3 years in this kind of National Trust property, and you know, not entirely, but some of that, I think, was people who had been perhaps to schools that looked and felt remarkably similar, and perhaps knew of either parents or siblings or friends who had passed through these institutions before. And so there was just a greater familiarity. I think it took me the best part of 2 years to actually kind of become familiar with how the place worked and what it was that was revered when you were doing kind of academic work. And then, because I'm a very competitive bloke by instinct, by the final year, when I felt like I had got the measure of the place, I worked like hell and sort of did all right in the end, and sort of, you know, in that sense, left in a fairly sort of upbeat frame of mind. But whenever I'm asked about the best thing about Cambridge, I said this at the time and I still say it now, the answer is the A1 northbound.
Good answer. Very good answer. Can you give us some context to your current imposter syndrome? What sort of a situation that you might find yourself in now, Chris, leaves you feeling like you don't belong there?
It doesn't happen as much as it did. I remember when I first presented breakfast television about 3.5 years ago. I had a little pang of it then, because there you are sitting on that red sofa in Salford, sitting next to the brilliant Naga Munchetti, who was the most wonderful person to present that programme with for the first time, because she was sort of hugely reassuring and helpful, and took me out for a drink the night before to sort of say hello, because we'd not properly met physically before then. She was just absolutely superb. But yeah, when you're sitting there for the very first time with your earpiece in, I'd never presented on the telly before in any context, as a presenter as opposed to a reporter, that there is, I kind of think you wouldn't be human if just for a nanosecond the thought didn't cross your mind, what on earth am I doing here? So I do remember it then. And when I did the first Any Questions, I had less of it actually when I did the first Any Questions. But I remember that, which was 18 months ago, Reading University, about 700 people in the room. I remember saying to the editor, if you told me the audience in the room was going to be this big, I'd have asked to start next week, not this week. Because I was thinking this would be nerve-wracking, even if we weren't being broadcast. You know, if it was like a town hall meeting, this is quite a thing. And so, I mean, I was nervous that night, obviously, because it was making it for the first time, you know, presenting my own programme where my name was above the door as opposed to Depping. And it is a different feeling when it's your own programme without question. But yeah, so you get occasional blasts.
You're also picking up from a Dimbleby there as well, right?
Yeah, I know. I mean, how ridiculous. I mean, oh my goodness. Yeah, exactly. I was thinking, I mean, Jonathan was wonderful beforehand in sharing sort of thoughts and tips, and he'd done it for 32 years. So, I mean, my goodness. I've done 18 months and I feel like I know vastly more now than I did when I started. And I've only done sort of 60, 70 shows. He did 32 years worth of shows. But yeah, I was thinking when I started that show, I thought, hang on a minute. I don't think there is a bigger surname in British broadcast news since broadcasting was invented. Yeah. You know, with the two brothers and then their father before them. And I'm taking over from one of them. That is absolutely ludicrous. Absolutely, on a program that's been going for 70 odd years and has only had five, you know, named presenters. Obviously, there's been lots of depths down the years, but five actual sort of names above the door presenters. How ridiculous. I think it probably helped me in terms of my nerves that he stopped about 6 or 7 months before I started. So there was various depths that did it for 6 or 7 months. So it was a little bit of a buffer. So the listener wasn't quite exposed to the contrast between this incredible professional at the peak of his broadcasting powers, and then Egypt Mason turning up a week later. There was a little bit of a gap, which is probably a good thing. But yeah, I mean, you know, that did feel, I mean, that did feel astonishing. But yeah, I think I get fewer of those imposter syndrome moments. Still get it now and again. As I say, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. And I think that, you know, the great joy in our game is that, you know, you're only as good as your last show, but the most important show you'll ever do is the next one.
I don't want to pile the pressure on here because I know you're on air with any questions later on today. it feels like, you know, just from some you know, somebody who's sort of quite used to being behind the microphone and quite used to sort of holding people to account and you know, and trying to sort of wade through the detail of story, you know, it feels like a mountain to climb in terms of keeping people on track, correcting people where they're wrong, being across the details of just almost anything, right? I mean, it can sort of, I mean, I know you, there's sort of a bit of prep in terms of what the questions are going to be, but it can go into all sorts of different directions. How do you approach it? How do you approach preparing yourself for 8 o'clock on a Friday?
It's a good question. I mean, the lesson I've learned is the absolutely key skill of being a speech radio presenter is listening. That is the key skill. Everything else is secondary to that. You can make the program sound significantly better by getting the choreography right. And that's taken time to work on. So thinking about how many questions are you going to attempt to get through? Where are your junctions for getting from one question to the next so that you don't get into a situation where it's obvious to the listener that you're chasing your tail towards the end? That's a work in progress every week, and I don't always get it right. The nature of a live debate with four panelists is, of course, you never quite know when it's going to catch fire. And Sod's law is it'll catch fire at just the point you're approaching one of those crucial time junctions. Mm-hmm. And you're thinking, if I let this catch fire and go, is it worth it? Because that fifth question I'm quite keen to do will probably be a victim of allowing this to go. But yet listening, I mean, I think listening is the key. When I listen back, so I have the curious privilege with any questions of being able to listen back at the point that most of the audience hear the program, because we go out live on a Friday night, but our bigger audience is on a Saturday lunchtime by about three times the audience is on a Saturday lunchtime compared with Friday night. So I listen back on a Saturday lunchtime having lunch. So I'm listening as most of the audience is listening. And there is nothing more frustrating as the presenter listening to your own show and hearing something that for some reason you didn't hear when the program was going out. In other words, when it was live the night before. And you think, why did I not hear that? Because that's what I should have picked them up on. But I think the other thing is reading, you know, trying to read all the time. I'll spend most of this afternoon reading stuff. We never quite know where the questions are going to go, of course, until pretty late in the day. But we've got a reasonable idea because you kind of know where the news agenda is. And then getting that balance right. And you face, I know, this same dilemma, really. And it's always the dilemma when you're interviewing people. To what extent do you let people talk versus interrupting them? Because sometimes when you let people talk, they tell you the most amazing stuff. And sometimes when you let people talk, they just talk drivel forever. And you can't be certain at the start of a particular answer whether you're going to get option A or option B. And then when all of your contributors are down the line, as almost all the time they are at the moment for me, then you're trying to do this roundtable discussion involving me and four panelists, and the four panelists are in four different places. And that doesn't necessarily help. And then you've got the vagaries of people's broadband and then the doorbell going and the children running in and all of that. And as I say, I think that there's something quite nice about that. There's a kind of a relatable authenticity about that, but it doesn't make a roundtable discussion easier to handle. There's no way. It definitely makes it harder, because when I'm out on the road and we've got everyone on the stage, I'm like some sort of demented traffic manager waving my arms around like a lunatic. And why am I doing that? Because, you know, if you can communicate non-verbally, particularly to sort of manage people's answers towards a conclusion, which is a polite way of saying shutting them up, if you can do that without saying, sorry, I'm gonna have to move on now, you know, there's only so many ways you can say that, and it starts sounding clunky. And I know it annoys some of our audience. You know, if you can sort of wave your arms around, which I do a lot of when they're in front of me, then you can manage and choreograph the conversation in a far more subtle, easy on the ear way. And people on the whole do respond when you start sort of gesticulating wildly in their face. And also when you're in front of a live audience, people respond and end an answer if they can tell the room finds it boring.
Is there any bit of this new normal that we've come to adapt to that you're quite enjoying?
I honestly cannot think, if I'm really honest, of a single of a single advantage. I miss the travel. I miss the, yeah, I just, yeah. I mean, you know, as I say, I've been very fortunate, but it's horrible, isn't it? I just want it to end.
Yeah, yeah. But I know it also strikes me that a lot of your job is kind of being across what's happening in the corridors of Westminster, right? And so much of that is done via just catching people, right? And catching totally. People in person, just asking a minister or an MP or a committee member or whatever what they're thinking about a certain thing. And all of that part of what you do has been just sucked out of the job, I guess.
Totally. And that's a mirror image, I would say, of kind of everyone's broader life, really, which is that our lives have become a lot thinner, haven't they? A lot grayer on the whole. And what I've realised is that what is so valuable in day-to-day life and is hugely valuable in day-to-day Westminster journalism is incidental conversation. It's the kind of things that you easily dismiss as being sort of pointless or just filling the time of day. But that actually, and as I say, apply this to your personal life or I can apply it to my professional life. At the moment, if I want to find out what's going on with particular politicians or, you know, people working in and around Westminster, I've got to ring them up. Well, that's fine. You ring them up all the time in normal times. But you got to, on the whole, you ring somebody with for a reason. Now, the conversation might meander off that reason once you're chatting to them, but you tend to ring them for a reason. Whereas the great value of Westminster, the kind of ultimate gossip postcode, is that you wander about and you bump into people in the street, in the lift, in the queue at the canteen, in the corridors, and you chat to them for a bit, and you might pick up a little snippet. Now, that little snippet might not be of much value in and of itself, but then 10 minutes later, you bump into someone else, and you start assembling these snippets, and you start getting a sense of what's going on, or you get a sense of the mood of a political party or whatever it might be. It's something you can't measure. There's no physical way of measuring, but you can feel it. But you can't do that with people sort of scattered around everywhere. And even when you walk around Parliament, and there are still a reasonable number of people who, you know, are there for some of the time, you know, like in any workplace, there's sort of, you know, oh, you can only walk down this corridor in this direction. And if you want to go the other way, you've got to walk down the corridor one floor up or whatever, you know, all that kind of stuff. Perfectly sensible mitigations against the risks that we are facing. I don't dispute that, but it removes that kind of that incidental chat. And I, you know, does that make the journalism harder? Yes, it does. Does it make it harder to have a properly rounded sense of what's going on? Yes, it does. But, you know, there's, for me, one thing that's arguably more important than both of those things, it's not as fun. And journalism and reporting is a huge privilege, and, you know, it plays its role in the democratic process and all that kind of high-minded stuff, which I hugely believe in. But it's fun at its best. It is just great fun. And is it as much fun at the moment as it would be normally? No.
I don't want to push the imposter syndrome thing as well, but one element of that, presumably, correct me now if I'm wrong, is that journey from, you know, from bedroom in Yorkshire, listening to Rock FM, to the corridors of power, to being stood on Downing Street. Your job involves, you know, communicating what's going on behind one of the most famous doors on the planet, some of the most important people on the planet, a place that is steeped in history and privilege and entitlement and, you know, the establishment. Is there any element of that that ever sort of creeps towards feeling imposter syndrome?
No, I don't think so. And in fact, actually, I almost think the opposite applies, in that because I've rattled around at Westminster Tower for quite a while now, I've got to remind myself not to take it for granted. And so when you walk out of Westminster Tube and you look up at the Elizabeth Tower that houses Big Ben, I mean, that's arguably the most famous sort of building in the country. And I walk past it on my way to work every day. And in fact, you know, I've got a pass to wander around in there. And similarly, when I walk into Downing Street and say hello to the coppers on the gate and go through security and then, you know, stand getting rained on opposite that door. I mean, I do that a lot. And so you can very easily take that for granted. And I've been inside quite a lot. And, you know, you can take that for granted when it's kind of part of your job. And of course, you know, when you step back, of course, that's a colossal privilege and something that so few people get the chance to do. As I say, I think the opposite applies for me around that, because I think the slight issue around people who've been at Westminster for quite a long time, and I kind of fall into that category now, is that the danger is you become that bit more detached from sort of people's day-to-day concerns, and you can get swept up in the reality, in the sort of, you know, obsessions of the quote-unquote Westminster bubble. Although that very phrase I kind of recoil from, because, and you might think that's because I've gone native, and maybe I have, but for me, the wonderful thing ultimately about Westminster, whatever you might think of individual sort of policies or parties or people, is that you've got this collection of 650 people who by definition are from every single corner of the UK and are returning to those different corners of the UK the whole time in normal times. Come therefore with a whole set of kind of instincts and priorities in their head that reflect, you know, to a greater or lesser extent, where it is that they represent, and being able to tap into that and hear those perspectives is a huge privilege. And as I say, in that sense, I think in many ways MPs are far more plugged in to what's going on by the nature of their day-to-day jobs than journalists can be, unless we proactively make an effort to, you know, get out and about, not be in London too often, you know, or speak to loads and loads of people who are hearing loads and loads of perspectives from all over the country. And if you're sort of any good journalistically, then that's what we're doing kind of all the time.
Mm. Oh no, we've lost you to the Westminster, defending the Westminster bubble. Northerner down. No, it's a really good point that you make, that, isn't it? It's a really, really good point that it is, as much as it's kind of like a centralized pillar of the establishment, if you will, it is also made up of hundreds of people who every week spread themselves across the country and go and experience life in other parts of the country.
Exactly. And so, and I kind of think, I mean, it says something to me that when you spell out that sort of simple fact, which is an indisputable fact around how it works, that actually goes quite a long way to offering a kind of counter, if you like, to some of the stuff that is lobbed around about, you know, every occupier of the postcode, irrespective of their kind of political affiliations, being somehow, you know, screamingly out of touch.
It's a really good point. You also are defending Westminster's role in our lives, democracy, and you mentioned about the privilege of sort of playing the role of check and balance, holder to account in journalism is in a really interesting place at the moment, a difficult place, you could argue. On the one side, the pressures of technology and Google and mass communication, tools of mass communication. On the other side, you know, a conscious effort from some to try to discredit journalism for, you know, it is in their interest that they discredit what you do. Do you ever fear for journalism?
It's a really interesting and crucial kind of conversation, this, isn't it? I think the way I kind of wrestle with this is that I've come to realize or come to the view, and maybe you might conclude this is a self-serving view, but that never before, with this explosion of outlets and this constant wall of noise as far as opinion is concerned, that it's never been more important, even though arguably bigger questions are being asked about it than ever before, to have outlets in the mix whose absolute central mission is this idea of due impartiality, this idea that you leave your own views at the door, you assemble a range of perspectives, whether you're telling a story on the news or you're doing a panel discussion, and you challenge all arguments based on the evidence around how that argument is assembled and facts, and then you let the listener, the viewer, the reader decide. I just think that is so, so important. I mean, on my first day at ITM, we had it drummed into us. You know, we were told, congratulations, you pulled through your opinionectomy operation, which is a phrase I'll never forget. Now, of course, we all come with our own, as we talked about earlier, our own sort of backgrounds and perspectives, of course, and you need newsrooms and radio stations and TV stations that are as broad-based in their backgrounds and perspectives as you, in every sense, as you can possibly imagine, because that just makes for better. It just makes everywhere better, I think, and makes us all better. But for me, and as I say, some people might think this is a superbly self-serving argument, but I genuinely believe it. I just think it is so, so important. I'm all for and spend loads of time listening to, you know, opinion-led stuff on the telly, on the radio, in the papers, online. But I kind of think you're always going to need, and I hope there'll always be a kind of interest in a market for, however that's done commercially or via sort of public funding, however that is done, for clear, impartial, thoughtful journalism and discussion and content and output. I just think, yeah, that's so, so important. Will there be a growing market or appetite for that, or a declining one, given the incredibly fast moving shifts in the media landscape? I don't know is the honest truth. I wouldn't even try and predict, because I think these things are just so unpredictable. But that would be my one sort of real hope, broadcasting wise, that is what there'll always be a desire to produce. And then crucially, because if there'll only be a desire to produce it if there is a market for it or an interest in it by the audience, that is still something that is, I hope, always to be valued by the audience.
Do you feel like it's under threat?
I think you have to keep making the case for it. So I suppose the direct answer to the question is yes, arguably it is, because more questions are asked of it. And in the internet era, if you like, of the last 20, 25 years, where we can so easily be exposed to such a broad range of stuff from all over the world in the way that is so, so different from, you know, back in the mid 90s when I was listening to Rock FM and Radio Lancashire, and the physical number of media outlets you could consume were finite, weren't they? I mean, you couldn't quite count them on one hand, but you could count them on the fingers of a couple of people's hands. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I used to get excited when I went abroad because I'd be able to pick up a copy of the, you know, whatever it might be, New York Times or whatever, because there was nowhere else you could see that sort of stuff, right? Because, you know, pre sort of internet. So I think, yeah, I think in that sense, that the revolutions that are sweeping through the media now, and that younger generations, particularly teenagers and those in their 20s, have seen nothing other than, does mean that you have to remake the case for the kind of broadcasting structures, if you like, that were taken for granted a generation ago because they were the only things that were there. So, to answer your question directly, yes, I think, you know, of course you always have to sort of make that case. But then of course you should, because, you know, whatever outlet or range of outlets or whatever you work for, if you can't make a compelling case for people to want them as part of their lives now, then you've got no reason to assume that you can carry on existing. So I mean, in that sense, you know, of course. But yeah, I think it's an argument that has to be made. I've never struggled with the kind of concept of impartiality. I find it a liberating and hugely valuable central tenet of kind of everything that I do. But I struggle to be impartial about the notion of impartiality, because I just think it is so, so important. For me, it's the sort of, it is the thing that is at the absolute core of what sort of motivates me sort of journalistically. And as I say, that's not to denigrate those who are in the business of being far more opinion led. Of course, there should be space for that. And as I say, I listen to loads of it myself. But for me, that's the driving kind of motivation. I have never any desire to do stuff that is led by opinion, as opposed to being led by that sort of bedrock of due impartiality.
So that's in terms of your sort of career, that's not something that you would fancy gear changing into at some point?
No, I wouldn't. And I'd be hopeless at it, because I don't have a coherent set of views about stuff. I don't spend any time thinking about them. I'm always thinking about ideas and arguments and, you know, what's the weak point in this argument or that, because that's kind of what I'm paid to do in terms of challenging and scrutinizing. But no, I don't. I never really have, to be honest, but I've had less and less of the longer I've done the job. And as I say, of course, you've always got to check your own prejudices and your own instincts and all of that. Nobody, you know, we're all human beings. None of us kind of can sail above it all entirely. But I think as a basic kind of principle, I do think it's something worth sort of arguing for, making the case for, and defending. So yeah, no, I would never go into that kind of thing. As I say, and I neither would I be hired to do that, because I'd be hopeless at it, because I'd be asked, hey, what do you think about X? And I'm like, well, it's a bit of this, and then, but on the other hand, that, I'd be like, oh yeah, do us a favor, that's not what we want. So I couldn't, you know, as I say, I wouldn't want to do it, and I wouldn't be able to do it. So that's a neat tessellation of two things. You know, the frustrations lie when the stuff you really want to do, but people won't let you do.
Sure.
If the stuff that you don't want to do and you wouldn't be able to do and no one would hire you to do, well, that's kind of a good thing, isn't it? That's a neat tessellation of things that are never going to happen.
Yes, that's a very fair point. It's a very fair point. I'm conscious that you've got lots and lots of reading to do for any questions, but I've got two or three more lines of inquiry, if you
like. Go for it. Sound like a lawyer I'm in the witness box here.
I think that the interviewer to interviewee, that's not a bad dynamic, actually.
Yeah, yeah, true.
Quite a helpful
true.
Dynamic.
Yeah. Your Honor.
You are not afraid to respond to criticism on Twitter. That's one of the things I've noticed at you. And by which I mean, criticism, I mean, sort of, you know, if somebody sort of points out that you know, they feel like you skewed one way with a vox pop or something like that. You know, you're quite forward in saying, you know, actually, here's my thinking behind my back. Do you think that journalism and journalists need to do a bit more of that? And it's just a stand up for itself a bit more sometimes.
Social media, in theory, is meant to be this sort of two-way street. So my view has always been to reply, and I do reply to most people. And I think it's not unreasonable that the lay person doesn't have a rounded understanding of, say, the news gathering process or the assembly of a report, or indeed the absolutely fundamental bedrock of that notion of due impartiality, or indeed understanding what that concept even is. So I think it's important to kind of explain it and offer an explanation. My kind of strategy is always to be, I'll happily be quite sort of direct and answer somebody directly, but I always try and make sure, and I'm sure there's plenty of examples of where I've failed, but I always try and make sure I'm polite, particularly in response to people who have been anything other than that. And I can understand the temptation of somebody to sort of shout at someone who's perceived to be sort of, I don't know, in authority or in a privileged position. So I understand the human instinct to do that, but my instinct is yes to engage, yes to try and explain. The problem, of course, with Twitter is that, you know, there's no depth there, because you can only offer a couple of sentences and things then look very kind of staccato and blunt and direct, when if you were having a conversation, you'd hear tone of voice and people could be more nuanced. And, you know, you would see the smile. You can't really see the smile. Things always seem much more bald and blunt. So it's far from ideal. I sometimes imagine myself thinking, oh, this is ridiculous and I shouldn't be on Twitter and I should just give up on it, and it would save oceans and oceans of time. It would, but I think I'm addicted, if the truth be known. And also it's kind of an important tool journalistically. I still think I could use it journalistically and spend rather less time on it, which is an ongoing battle. But yeah, on the whole, I do think engaging is important. I really do.
I haven't tweeted since Tuesday, which is I'm incredibly proud of.
That is impressive.
But it's the problem for us is that actually, okay, that is impressive, but I could probably do with ramping up my game a bit and, you know, and do it a bit more. But it is, do you know what I always found that I wonder if maybe you agree with this. All those things that you and I really love about radio, the intimacy, the power of it, how you can sort of really get into the nuances of things. Everything that I love about what got me into this job is completely absent from a part of the job that is, for one reason or another, so important. Twitter.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a really important distinction, actually. It doesn't have the sophistication and the range that a radio conversation can have, where you can hear someone's voice and their tone and the timbre of their voice and their pacing and the language that they choose. And you can hear whether they're smiling or crying. You know, there's a sophistication. It's three-dimensional and it's intimate. And Twitter is none of those things, because it's not sophisticated, it's not three-dimensional, and it's not intimate. Now, it's kind of here to stay, and it's an important element of the kind of, you know, broadcasting apparatus that we all kind of grapple with. But I'm increasingly of the kind of instinct that it's not a positive contributor to my daily experiences. I've just looked, by the way, I've gone 14 hours without tweeting, which for me, I mean, that's the equivalent of your 3 days.
Is it? Yeah, yeah.
I tweeted last night about an article I'd read, which was an interview with a national radio presenter. And the question that I took a picture of and tweeted was, what would people be surprised to know about you? Answer, I have a third nipple.
Who was the radio presenter? Do we know who the radio
presenter? I do know who it is, but maybe I should tease until you get to the end of your last question and then I'll reveal it right
okay.
at the end.
Okay, that's a good tease. Good. See, there's some radio craft at work there, Chris. Okay, the second of my final three lines of inquiry, Your Honour. In March this year, last year, well, it all just feels like one big rolling mess, doesn't it, at the moment. You and I had a little bit of DM interaction, and I said to you, and there was a line that you said said in one of your messages to me. He said, "I thought that Brexit was an incredible story to cover, but this is off the scale." If you could take a bit of a breath and think about the weight and the scale and the size of what has happened since you took on the role that you now have, and the stuff that you have covered. Does at any point that just become a little bit overwhelming?
Yeah, I mean, what's been really striking about this covering the pandemic is that I realised when we started covering the pandemic that the great luxury I'd had in almost every single story I'd covered in the previous best part of 20 years, I had been detached from. I had been the reporter who turned up, looked at the story, told it and went home, and effectively left it behind at work. To a greater or lesser extent, there are some stories, you know, incredibly personal stories that stick with you because they're just incredibly moving. There are others like Brexit that kind of hover in the national conversation for a long time. But then the pandemic came along. And what I was struck by, because we were stuck at home for a fortnight right at the beginning, because one of my little ones got some symptoms, and was that this was a story that nobody had the luxury of detaching themselves from. We were all participants. And I revere in my normal journalistic work prior to the pandemic being the observer, not the participant. I don't want to be a participant. I want to be an observer. But this pandemic doesn't afford that luxury. And as I say, that was rammed home to me at the beginning when we were all stuck at home. We were all fine in the end. And you know, being stuck at home for a while has become entirely normal. But at the time, it didn't feel it. So yeah, it's been extraordinary, hasn't it? I had this brief and incredibly naive month, which was January 2020. So we just had the general election. A sizable majority government has been elected. The jeopardy around whether Brexit would or wouldn't happen had gone because it was about to happen. And yes, there was going to be the whole row about a trade deal and all that kind of stuff. But basically, jeopardy had left the building politically after this incredible period where it hung in the air of every building in Westminster every day of the week. And I thought to myself, you know, I've kicked around at Westminster for quite a while. I've just covered all these elections and referenda and blah-de-blah-de-blah. And here we are. And it's not going to be very exciting anymore. And I wonder if, bluntly, I should go and find another job and do something else, because maybe covering politics is never going to be quite the same again. And then what happened, you know, about 6 weeks later, we're in the middle of a pandemic. And I was reminded of something I was told when I first started working at Westminster, which is the great joy of it, is that that building over the road from our newsroom, i.e. Parliament, is not only the biggest news factory in the country in terms of the stories it generates itself, but every big story, locally, regionally, nationally and internationally, gets channeled through it. So even though a pandemic is something that my colleagues in, you know, who cover health are kind of all over and have been covering extraordinarily for the best part of a year, obviously in a pandemic, huge elements of it are political decisions. So they become the job of a political correspondent to report. And so suddenly, having covered what I thought was probably the most extraordinary story I would ever cover, Brexit, 2 months later, it was shown to be a very passionate argument about a battle of political ideas. And that's not to denigrate how important those thoughts and ideas and arguments are, but that's what it was and is. And along came something that was this real and present danger to our health and to our liberties and to our businesses and our economies and our education and our ways of life, the likes of which haven't happened in the lifetimes of most people in this country right now. Suddenly, we're confronted, as I say, by this colossal story. And there's nothing more compelling as a journalist than covering stories that you know the audience are attached to and it resonates with, for whatever reason. And clearly, because the pandemic is something that is so central to all of our lives at the moment, then when you're reporting on it, you can be reasonably sure. I mean, people might be sick of hearing about it, but you can be reasonably sure that people are going to be engaged in what you've got to say, because it matters to whether or not the kids are going to go back to school at some point in the coming weeks, or their business survives, or they'll get paid that furlough money, or whatever it might, or the universal credit, or whatever it might might be. And so journalistically, in an entirely sort of self-centered sense, you're very conscious that you're covering a story that really matters. And in that sense, in a job satisfaction sense, you know, when you feel like you're making a difference because what you're doing is being listened to and consumed and valued, then it feels like you're doing something worthwhile. But I have to say, I said this to a boss the other day, actually, very rare that you'll hear a journalist admit that they quite like to cover a boring story. But between you and me, Darrell, I wouldn't mind it. I wouldn't mind covering some crashingly boring story, because if I was allowed on the air to cover a crashingly boring story, that would probably mean the schools are open, the pubs are open. I could get a decorator in to sort out various problems in the house. And very, you know, and in other words, life's returning to normal. So I'm almost up for doing a couple of boring stories. The trade-off is that we can have our lives back.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I remember during the earliest months of it, March to the summer period, being on air, and I kind of made that point myself on air, you know, Chris, that I don't ever remember being a part of something or talking about something in all of my broadcasting career, which hasn't always been kind of newsy and current affairsy, that reaches into every single person that is listening. Person that is consuming what I am saying right now is being affected by it. And including, and you mentioned this and you touched on this, including us, right? Including you.
Mm.
And I spoke last year about sort of just needing to take a bit of a break from it. Just the relentless nature of it was getting a bit much for me. And I just wonder how you, in your position, being on a front line of sorts, it has been for you. How are you?
I'm fine, I think. I mean, I think, you know, I can't think of any advantages, as I say, of the current situation at all. And I'm craving for it all to be over and all the rest of it. So in that sense, you know, like so many of us, I'm just sort of worn down by it and sick of it. But I'm not in the hospital that's about half a mile down the road from our house, where goodness knows what it's like. Whereas what do? I mean, I sit in front of a microphone or in front of a camera and do my best to try and keep people informed, really. So it does mean that you're constantly surrounded by it. But then, as you say, because everybody is constantly surrounded by it in their own way, because you might be, I don't know, on furlough, or you might have been made redundant, or you might be working on the front line in a ICU, a hospital, or whatever. In that sense, I don't think my experience is any different from anybody else's, other than the upsides. The upsides being that it is a incredible privilege to be telling a story that matters to so many people, to be in stable and fulfilling work, and to be able to get out the door and go into a workplace a lot of the time, which for my own kind of well-being, if you like, day to day, is an element of normality that is a luxury at the moment, because lots of people don't have it. I kind of feel like I've been coping relatively well. My wife would probably tell you that I'm sort of more miserable than normal, but I think that might well have happened anyway. I think, you know, in that sense, you know, and the journalist in me is always wanting to be understanding and grappling with the things that are the most compelling things of our time. And, you know, clearly, for all the wrong reasons, this pandemic is that in spades.
Okay, final line of inquiry.
Before the big nipple reveal.
Before the big nipple reveal. Yeah, I'm excited about the nipple reveal.
Good.
And I'm sorry, I couldn't not mention this. Halloween 2020. That famous night where we got the news that there would be a briefing from the Prime Minister at about 4:30 or something like that. It was then delayed and delayed and delayed again.
Yeah. I've just remembered what you're talking about.
I thought it would be burnt in your memory, this whole this whole experience. But you were, so just to fill the gap in case people didn't see it or come across it, but you were on national television effectively filling, right, for like 3 hours or something like that.
Yeah, so it was me and Rita Chakrabarti, and it was one of these news conferences on a Saturday afternoon, of which there have been loads, and they often run a little bit late, and it was due at 4:00. And what's been happening is that, you know, BBC One have been taking these news conferences as well as the BBC News Channel. And so suddenly rolling news goes mainstream because the audience figures are huge. And basically we had an awfully long wait. So I went in to chat to Rita. I mean, it was Rita who deserves all the plaudits, really, because I was just kind of sitting next to her and waffling away when we needed to fill a bit of time, which, as it turns out, we had an awful lot of time to fill, because she went on air, it was either 4 or 4:30. By the time she went on air, it may have already been pushed back by half an hour. Anyway, I went on air And I remember, I think at about 10 to 5, I'd said on the air, oh, you know, this news conference is going to be starting at around about 5 o'clock. And I got a text from somebody in Downing Street. So it was clearly being watched in there by somebody who said, when you say around 5 o'clock, you might be better off saying from 5 o'clock. And I replied and said, do I take from that that from means it's going to be rather later than around? Because from 5 o'clock could mean 5 past 5, and around 5 o'clock could mean 5 past 5. But my job at Westminster is to be, you know, interpret language, and every flipping word counts. And I did say, I think, you know, I won't blurt out what time you say, but it helps us plan if we have some idea about when it's likely to be. And if you want to tell me it's going to be a long way off, I'd rather hear that now than us keep telling the viewer that it's imminent. There was no reply, so I kept on talking, and I did say, look, I think this is going to slip a little bit, because I thought, I think that's a reasonable interpretation of the word from. And then I got a text, probably about 5:15. So we've been wittering away now on BBC One for about an hour, with not a lot to go to, because we didn't really want to go to anything, because we were expecting at any moment that, you know, he was going to barrel through those wooden doors and the press conference was going to get underway. I then got a text from somebody else in Downing Street that suggested it would be happening within the hour. Now, of course, again, within the hour can be 5 minutes away, but it can also be an hour away. So I then played for even more time on the air and said, look, I think this is getting pushed back quite a while. I think it might be around about 6 o'clock. And part of me was thinking, if I say something that they think is wrong, they'll text me. And I'll quite happily say, well, actually, I've now heard it's going to be 5:30. Quite happy to do that. But given they weren't replying to my text all the time, partly because, to be fair to them, I don't think they were quite sure what time it was going to be happening. And there's a lot of moving parts. And all I was obsessed about was when this press conference was going to start. Obviously, the Prime Minister's team have got a country to run and make sure the data's in the right place and make sure they know what they're going to say and what the implications of what they're going to say. And have they briefed the, you know, the devolved administration, all that kind of stuff. You know, governing is complicated. But anyway, in the meantime, I'm sort of wittering on. And what we're becoming increasingly aware of is that this was probably broadcasting to a bigger audience than I ever had and ever will broadcast to ever again, because we were heading into Saturday night prime time. And I was getting wind that there were all sorts of conversations going on at a very senior level within the BBC about exactly when this was going to happen, because we were running up against Strictly, which of course is live and is massive. And at one point I did point out to the viewer that they may have either turned on for a programme involving Little Mix, which had been binned, or had turned on for Strictly, and instead had Rita and I waffling away for Britain because we were waiting for this news conference, and that as a viewer, you may feel a little shortchanged. But the viewing figures were astonishing. I think the combined peak viewing figure was north of 20 million. I mean, that's only fools and horses territory from the 90s, you know. It was north of 20 million. And the combined audience across those sort of, the press conference in the end started at about 7:15 and then finished just as Strictly started.
By the way, I was going to ask you about that because it did finish pretty much bang on when Strictly started, yes. Which gave BBC One an opportunity to sort of gear change out of the coverage and straight into Strictly.
On the news channel. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Was the Prime Minister, do you think Boris Johnson was sort of like, oh God, I better not deny the nation Strictly? Was that coordinated?
I think it wouldn't be, I wouldn't be revealing any state secrets if I said that I think it was pointed out to Downing Street when Strictly was due to start, and that the scope for flexibility around when this news conference may happen, if they wanted it on BBC One, was going to be limited around that particular window. And therefore, perhaps, you know, either get on with it beforehand or wait until afterwards or whatever.
It was some fine back timing as well, wasn't it, by the Prime Minister, to be fair?
Yes, and it was, coupled with the fact, I think, probably a willingness for Strictly to slip by a minute or two if he was just overrunning by a bit. But yes, I think there was a bit of choreography going on there. I had some nice texts from some quite sort of senior people in government and broadcasting after that, because it's one of those moments. It was entirely a complete fluke that happened to be me doing that, by the way, that day. It was just a fluke of the rotor and what I was asked to do. And it could easily have been a sort of 2 minute wonder before the news conference and turned into sort of the best part of 3.5 hours. I knew it was one of those days when the director and the editor of the program at one point said to me, can you keep this exchange quite short, no more than 6 minutes? And I was thinking, normally when I'm sitting in this chair, I might do a 50-second answer, or 1 minute 30 would be regarded as a long live. And I was asking to keep a contribution short to 6 minutes.
What a brilliant moment. And actually, not that this needed really cementing in the nation's psyche, but in that moment, actually, you know, I think we just got a sense of how good you are at your job, both of you. I mean, you're right to sort of call Rita out as well, how important you are, and not to want to be sort of too sycophantic, but actually how lucky we are to have you, who is able to do that, be across the detail, do what you do, and do it so diligently.
Oh, it's very kind of you to say. I think it's, I suppose it's that classic thing, isn't it? At moments like that, if you know, when those moments come along, if they come along at the right moment for you as a journalist, as a broadcaster, then what people see is the little bit of the iceberg above the water, and they don't see what has contributed to that, which is the air miles that you assemble over a career of all the different types of broadcasting that, if you're fortunate in our line of work, you might get the chance to do. And I did keep a cutting from the Craven Herald, my local paper back home in Yorkshire, that said 16 million watch Craven Boy waffling on forever, or something like that. And I thought, you know what, that newspaper, the very first place that I did journalistic work experience, has got, rightly, journalistic acumen and a knack of getting to the crux of the story, because that was a pretty fair reflection of what that amounted to.
And that's a lovely full circle for you. Lovely full circle. And you're right to say that, you know, the viewers are seeing the tip of the iceberg there, but underneath that is decades of kind of preparation and craft. And as much as those decades have been leading up to 8 o'clock tonight, when you will go live on Radio 4, there is also perhaps a little bit more iceberg to be put in place, a little bit more reading to do before any questions. So I'll let you get on with the rest of your life. But before we do that, Chris...
Oh, yeah, we've got the big reveal.
The big reveal. I think this is, frankly, the moment that we've all been waiting for.
We need one of these, you know, we need one of your drones or something that you might have used in your yes. Hit music radio days.
Shall I do drone? I'll do some droning in the background then. Okay, here we go.
Ba-boom, ba-boom, ba-boom. So this was Prospect magazine, which is one of the nerdy, the geekazines, as my wife calls them, that drops through the front door every so often. Interview with a radio presenter with a book out. And it said, what would people be surprised to know about you? I have a third nipple, not the same size as the other two, but it is definitely a nipple. And the possessor of that third nipple is James O'Brien.
Blimey. Well, there you go. There's the insight into his life that we didn't know we needed.
Exactly right. There you go.
Chris, it's been a real pleasure.
A joy to talk to you, Daryl. Really, really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much. And I you know, I mean it sincerely when I think that, you know, we touched on a lot of the stuff there about the importance of what you do and the diligence with which you do it. I mean it sincerely. This is not smoke being blown or being sycophantic for the sake of it. I genuinely think, you know, actually, this sounds incredibly lofty, but as a country and as a democracy, I think we are incredibly lucky to have you.
I am one of a cog. You know, one of a cog, and you're part of the cog, you know, you're part of the wheel, you know, that whole wheel of, I think, you know, the great joy of what we get to do is that it matters, doesn't it, in terms of, you know, democracy and an informed country and all that kind of high-minded stuff. But at the same time, it doesn't matter. You know, it's not teaching the next generation to read. It's not putting out a fire. It's not saving somebody's life in a hospital. And I kind of revel in that kind of it matters, but it doesn't matter thing.
Good point. Well made. Although don't bring me into it. I haven't tweeted since Tuesday. I'm only on at the weekends.
I bet you've been on Insta.
Yeah, fair enough. Insta. Okay, fair enough. Chris, thank you so much, my friend. Enjoy tonight.
Thank you, mate. Daryl, as I've known for a long time from listening, because the joy of having a just under 2-year-old son is that I am frequently up when you are broadcasting to the nation. And the last hour or so has rammed home what is obvious as a listener to me, which is that you're a brilliant interviewer and asking just terrific questions that get people to talk about stuff, hopefully, that is interesting. So hats off to you.
Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you. And I'm still recording, so I'm definitely keeping that in.
Brilliant.
Compliments all round. Well done, Daryl. And thank you to Chris as well for coming on this podcast. Over an hour of entertainment. We don't normally go over an hour. I don't know why. It's just something about the 60-minute mark. But thank you very much for continuing to listen. And we'll have something a little bit different, but probably the same next week here on the Radio Today programme.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics.
Original music for this podcast was composed by Macasso.